everyone. It's a pleasure and privilege to welcome you here to Shaarei Shamayim this evening for Ebola and Ethics, hosted by the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. The Ebola epidemic in West Africa has spiraled out of control, affecting thousands and threatening thousands more. To date, the virus has killed more than 4,900 people. Several factors about this outbreak have some of the world's top health professionals gravely concerned. One, its kill rate. From 30 to 90% of the infected die, depending on the level of medical care. Two, its exponential growth. At this point, the number of people infected is doubling, approximately every 3 weeks. Three, the gruesomeness with which it kills. By hijacking cells and migrating throughout the body to affect all organs, sometimes causing victims to bleed profusely. Four, how it is transmitted. Through contact with bodily fluids, including sweat, tears, saliva, blood, urine, semen, etc., including objects that have come into contact with bodily fluids, such as bed sheets, and clothing. Terrifying as these factors are, and it definitely is scary to think about, it's not clear to me that any of these factors truly capture what is horrifying, what is most horrifying about this disease. Professor Benjamin Hale wrote in a recent article that the most striking thing about the virus is the way in which it propagates. The mechanism Ebola exploits is far more insidious. The virus preys on care and love, piggybacking on the deepest, most distinctively human virtues. Affected parties are almost all medical professionals and family members, snared by Ebola while in the business of caring for their fellow human beings. Most strikingly, 75% of Ebola victims are women, people who do much of the care work throughout Africa and the rest of the world. Imagine you are a parent whose child has suddenly come ill with a fever. Do you cast your child away and refuse to touch him? Do you cover your face and your arms, stay back? Or do you comfort your child when he asks you, arms outstretched, to make the pain go away? Imagine you are a child of 5 years old and your mother is sick. She implores you to stay back, but you are scared. What you need more than anything else is a hug, a cry. In short, Ebola is eating away at the core of our humanity. It spreads through the loving care of a parent to child, a brother to a sister, a patient to a volunteer nurse. No sheet of plastic or latex can disrupt these human inclinations. We are human. Every mechanism we have for caring, touching, holding, feeding, playing, warming, comforting, caressing, every mechanism that we use to bind to our families and our neighbors is preyed upon by Ebola. We are humans and we will care about our children and our families, even if it means that we may die in doing so. Ebola threatens humanity by preying on humanity. We must find a method of caring without touching, of contacting without making contact. The physiological barriers are, for the time being, necessary, but we cannot stop people from caring about one another. So we must create, for the time being, mechanisms for caring. Since we will never be able to beat back humanity, we must coordinate humanity at the family level, the local level, and the global level. The public health community is doing an incredible job facing unbelievable risks, relying on extremely limited resources. This evening, we are here to examine mechanisms for caring. We are here to examine the ethics of Ebola, to take a careful look at the specific circumstances that arise and the most ethical way to conduct oneself in these situations. We have assembled experts in the area of public health and halakha to help us understand and appreciate the complexity of Ebola through the lens of ethics and halakha. It is really a great honor for me to welcome the panelists here this evening. We have on my right Dr. Barry Pakis, who is an assistant professor of clinical public health and global health at University of Toronto. He is a specialist in primary care and an ER physician who has a PhD in ethics and public health. Among his many career interests and research projects, he is currently working on ethical analyses in public health practice, empirical studies of global health ethics, and halakhic approaches to public health and global health ethics. It's great to have you here. Dr. Brian Schwartz, who is an associate professor at University of Toronto in family and community medicine and public health. He's the chief emergency preparedness, the chief at emergency preparedness at Public Health Ontario. His areas of expertise are many, including emergency management, emergency medical services, and his current research interests include providing leadership in research and evaluation of public health and health systems needs in capacity and emergency preparedness and response, establishing a formal research program in health emergency management in the Canadian context. Thank you for being here. It's great to have you. And Rabbi Mordechai Torchiner, the Rosh Beit Midrash of the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash Zichron Dov of Toronto since its founding in 2009, one of the most innovative and relevant Torah teachers of our time. Ordained at Yeshiva University, he served as a rabbi in Rhode Island and Pennsylvania before coming here. He specializes in blending different areas of Torah knowledge and utilizing diverse methods to develop curricula in Jewish history, Tanakh, Jewish law. Rabbi Torchiner delivers lectures all over Toronto. I'm a huge fan. I listen to many of the ones that I can't get to on YU Torah. And he lives in Thornhill with his wife and four children. So thank you so much for being here as well. And now I'm going to stop talking because I'm the least qualified up here to say anything intelligent. And I'm going to turn it over to our panelists. But before I begin, I just wanted to remind everyone that it would be really helpful if you could silence your cell phones so we can minimize disruptions. And just a little bit of a heads up about the structure for this evening. So I'm going to pose two questions, and Dr. Pakis is going to speak to these two issues, and then Rabbi Torchiner is going to respond from a Jewish perspective. And then I'm going to pose two more local ethical questions. The first two are going to be about global issues. The second two will be about local issues. And Dr. Schwartz will speak to those two issues, and then Rabbi Torchiner again will respond through a halachic lens. And then afterwards, we will have time for questions. Okay, I think we're ready to begin. So the first two questions are, should treatments be used if they have not undergone safety testing? And two, how should treatment recipients be prioritized? Floor is yours.
Okay, so I'm going to have to, not everyone can hear me without the, without the microphone, because I need to be near my computer. So thank you for the introduction. Thank everyone for being here. So I'm going to talk a bit about just general Ebola and answer some of these questions closer to the middle or the end here, just to give everyone an introduction with an aim towards setting up, hopefully, Reverend Torchiner's answers, which I understand Dr. Schwartz is going to be doing too. So a lot of this, my background again is in public health ethics, but I spent some time at the World Health Organization putting together the pandemic ethics plan for the WHO, so a lot of what I'm going to speak about is from there. First, Ebola, unless you've been living it's Shabbos 24-7 for about 2 months, you will have heard of Ebola, of course. Unfortunately, these slides aren't projecting that well, but there's a little piece of protein there which all the vaccines are aiming towards. This is the area of the world that it's in, and of course it started in the confluence of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, where it continues to spread, and as you all know, it's the worst, I'm moving too much, it's the worst Ebola epidemic in history. And it continues to grow, although it may have turned the corner a little bit. Those are the, so as you can see just from those graphs, the numbers keep going up. And the up in the corner there, the red line is, if it gets under control, it's going to sort of keep increasing about 10,000 per month or thereabouts. If it's totally under control, that green line up to hundreds of thousands of cases. So it's fairly obviously serious, as you've all appreciated, not just some of the fear and all the media hype is actually justified. The big concern, certainly for the public health community and very much for physicians, is that 400 of the first 2,000 dead were healthcare workers, many of them the leading folks in Liberia and those countries. And really, you can only understand how big an impact it had when you realize that about two-thirds of the doctors in Liberia, the country doctors in Liberia, died in the initial 2 months. So, you know, that's why it spread to big cities, because the hospitals in the rural areas could know there's only one doctor in them. Once that doctor is dead, everybody has to move to the big cities, and that's how it really spread. So a really huge impact, as I'm sure you know. This is one of the Ebola treatment centers, and basically the introduction Rabbi Chessis gave is sort of, you can't get quite an understanding of how horrible it is when you come with a family member to one of these centers, you drop them off there, and you can't hear from them basically until they die. And even once they die, they come out in a completely sealed black plastic bag that you don't even get to see, and they get cremated. So basically, once you drop someone off there, if the 70 to 90% chance they don't make it, that's pretty much all you've heard. And you only get in there when you get sick yourself. So it's pretty profound. This actually, unfortunately, you can't see at all, but in the back there is a bed, a cholera bed, which are being used for the Ebola epidemic. And if any of you, presume half of your physicians, but probably none of you are old enough to remember cholera beds where it has a hole that with a bag to collect all of the feces that are produced and which are very useful, because Ebola fundamentally is, or really is, a diarrheal type disease where dehydration is a huge part of what causes organ failure. This we'll be speaking quite a bit about. This is a pile of personal protective equipment, which of course is not only about getting personal protective equipment. This is from one person's one interaction. You can imagine how much all that costs, and then disposing of it. So not just getting it, wearing it, getting it off, disposing of it. It's extremely complex, and how that all works is both a logistical and ethical conundrum. Ebola thrives in dysfunctional or non-existent health systems, and I'm sure you've heard all about all the cases in the United States. There have been 9, only one death, and that person, as I'm sure you know, died not only because of Ebola, but really because he was a black man who came in 2000 to a hospital. And when that happened, of course, he was turned away with just some Tylenol and antibiotics. So in the United States, a lot of people are using it as an example of a health system sort of teetering on dysfunction, and that's one of the reasons people are most concerned. Rabbi Tortino can give me a bit of a funny look there, but that's my take on it. Of course, why care? So actually, one of my colleagues, David Fiskin at the School of Public Health, just released a paper talking about, based on the flight patterns, how many people we can expect to come to North America or Europe, and it's about 2.7 people from Liberia every month. If the infections continue as they are, we'll probably board a plane and get to the United States or Europe. And about 0.2, from Guinea, 2.7 a month, 0.2 from Liberia, and 0.6 from Sierra Leone. So, you know, it's coming here. That's why we have to worry, although we don't have to worry that much. It's an ethical problem, and it's our ethical problem. One of the reasons that the folks in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea can't get protective equipment is because over the past 2 weeks, and really over the past month, we've been buying it all. Actually, Brian's been buying it all. But anyway, the government of Ontario, and so the folks in those countries actually can't, we can pay an awful lot more than they can, and so there's actually an even bigger lack of protective equipment now than at some points in the past. And of course, as a public health physician in public health, you're not saving more lives in a week than a clinical physician saves in a lifetime. You're not doing your job. So that's why I personally care. And so that's why we're going to talk about, you're not going to pay any attention to the next 10 minutes, 15 minutes, you can always go pick up the book. That's a shameless plug for a book that doesn't quite exist, but when it does, you can all find it on Amazon. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the influenza pandemic and how it's sort of different, but some of the ethical principles that come from it. And when I was at the WHO in Geneva, we had four major areas we were gathering in working groups in order to answer these ethical questions, and they're exactly the same as the ones we're dealing with today. Prioritization of vaccines and antivirals, legitimate use of public health measures, the role of obligations of healthcare workers, researching, licensing, and use of biologics. And then transnational issues, which literally, you know, you could spend a day talking about mutual obligations of people and of governments and that sort of thing. Unfortunately, at that time, we could not even find one person to answer that question about the research licensing of biologics, and that was one of the things that blew up at that time at H5N1. If anybody paid attention at that time, it was a case in Indonesia that had the disease. That's what they made the vaccine from, and then everyone in Indonesia was like, well, we should own that. And we should be profiting from it. And then it was a matter of, well, maybe it should be that individual who had the disease, not the government of Indonesia, or who owns these sorts of things. So that was dropped, and Dr. Schwartz is going to speak about these two middle issues, and I'm going to talk mostly about the first. Tiny little thing before I get started with that issue is that even talking about ethics in these situations is an ethical issue and is a problem because it does take resources. We've spent millions of dollars at the WHO and elsewhere around the world over the past 10 years on trying to figure out how ethically to deal with these issues. And this is when I was promoting the pandemic plan in Taiwan to a number of African leaders. That's the Minister of Health and the Princess of Malawi there, and my wife was at the back. And when we said, you know, you need to start planning for the pandemic, she said, well, thank you very much. We have a pandemic. It's called HIV. We're a little bit busy in order to plan for anything else, and that's very much remains the case. So, what are our priorities? So answering some of those questions in terms of how we decide who gets what treatment, first we have to decide what our goal in terms of our response overall to the pandemic might be. So is our overall goal decreasing morbidity and mortality? Is it minimizing social disruption? Or is it restricting the area affected? Now each one of those you might think is part of a goal that we would be interested in, but you can't have all of them at the same time. In other words, I apologize if it's too small for some folks at the back. All of the above is not an option, and a lot of what my research has been doing is polling public health professionals and global health professionals around the world in terms of which one of those is most important to them and how that actually manifests in some of their plans. Because people do think, including the Canadian government, until 2004, we had all three of those as our goal, and you can't really have all three at the same time. What are justifiable rationing strategies? Do we provide treatments just to those who are socially useful? In other words, generally in most societies, the lowest class who's actually doing the work and the highest class who can afford to pay for them, which is how it works out in many societies, and I'll talk about that. Ability to pay, previous injustice, need, there's all kinds of other of ways we can do that. And one of the biggest questions is who should be making this decision, which I'm only going to allude to today. And based on what values, principles, and processes, I'm going to highlight a few of them, a broad array of them. I'm not going to try to make sort of a coherent argument. Hopefully, Rabbi Torchiner is going to be doing that from the Jewish perspective, which incidentally is usually the position I'm put in as the only person, obviously, at the WHO who had a kippah on. I was less being asked, what do I think in terms of ethical principles, but what do I think in terms of as a Jew, which at the time and still now is sort of an amaretz with respect to most of this stuff. I'll skip through that. That was just a Canadian plan. So this is how we make decisions in global health and public health. You have some, you know, a knowledge base, evidence. You pass judgment on that, and it leads to some kind of outcome. In other words, there are facts that they sort of filter through our biases and our perceptions. We call that evidence, and then we apply some kind of logic or thinking to it. But it's critically important to realize that how we affect those decisions is also very challenging, and there's a lot of ethical dimensions to it. And I'll be talking about all those elements. One small area I think that's critically important tonight is that when I ask people, there's about 10,000 people that I've asked around the world, should ethical principles be derived from religious documents? As you can see, Canadians tend to be a little on the less religious end of things. Canadian nurses, Canadian physicians, Americans, about 38%. That's a lot of the reason for the issues that they have is there's real... it's hard to get anything done when people have very different sort of metaphysical perceptions about what should actually happen. We're going to see that in a couple of days in the election. But interestingly, this is the group from West Africa, who I was actually teaching while in Israel. About 50% of them feel that religious documents should have an impact on how global health and public health decisions are made, which is really very shocking to most other public health folks, certainly those in Canada, because religious documents usually don't feature that prominently. So, in terms of ethics, there's all kinds of different areas in ethics. What we're going to talk about is public health ethics, not clinical ethics, institutional ethics, research ethics, or global health ethics. All of them might sound exactly the same to most of you. They're very different fields of study, and one of the greatest challenges is having clinicians who are trained in clinical ethics apply a lot of those principles to public health ethics. Oftentimes you get answers or results that don't make an awful lot of sense to public health practitioners. And this is, I'm just going to show you the big picture. So this is the public health analytical reasoning tool, which my wife suggested changing the name, which we did. So now it's called the GERM, the Global Health Ethical Reflection Matrix. There's a whole bunch of parts in there. I don't have time to talk about it. But just to let you know that if what I'm saying doesn't, in the next, let's say, 8 minutes, doesn't satisfy you. Oh, my timer stopped. So basically, if I don't intellectually satisfy you, there is an answer out there that, if we had an 8-hour workshop, we could do. So here's who decides. There's all kinds of answers to that question. The medical officer of health, an expert group, ethicists or rabbis or imams or priests. The mayor, so usually when I present this internationally, that always elicits a big, all kinds of laughs from the crowd, so sadly that's over for me. The people, so a lot of people feel, well, this is such an important decision, there should be some kind of referendum about it. That rarely happens, and usually it is a political decision, unfortunately, so many people aren't comfortable with that. Or the WHO. So this is the World Health Organization Strategic Health Operations Center. Until about 2 months before I worked there, this was a movie theater. And for those of you who think that the UN always is focused on Israel, in fact, Israel is in the map right there, right in the center, because we were in the middle of the H5N1 crisis. So you've got Turkey and Israel in there. So who gets vaccines? That's finished the introduction, so I have 5 minutes for the rest of it. So who gets vaccines and antivirals? The traditional priority setting answer, the one that you would answer if I said, the Titanic is sinking, who do you save?
Women
and children, right? Everybody says that. Why do you save women and children? Usually when I teach students, we have a long discussion about that. In theory, it's kids because you're maximizing the potential years of life lost, right? Kids have more lives, more years of life to live, so you want to maximize the number of years to live. So in some ways that makes sense. Women, why maximize the number of people on Earth, right? You want to keep the fertile people alive to populate the world, right? Because there's only 7.5 billion, we need a lot more. So once you say it that way, then people often have misgivings about that. Of course, if you're saving women and children, and that's your reason, you're only saving women between the ages of 15 and 45. And people giggle about that, but that has to be in plans because there are only certain people. We're not talking about influenza where there's going to be millions of doses. We're talking about, there were 1,000 doses of the treatment for Ebola. And of course, both are fundamentally vulnerable, so a lot of people are not necessarily comfortable with the fact that women, just because of their nature, are fundamentally vulnerable these days. So the traditional answer doesn't usually satisfy most people. And of course, in practice, it's never really the women and children. It's usually the men and rich, politically powerful. And in this situation with Ebola, the people who are getting treated are the people from rich countries or the people who are wealthy and can afford treatment to some extent. We try to push back against that, but in some ways, that's what would have happened had the entire response really not been organized and effected by Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, for the most part. So here's the practical answer. So when Dr. Schwartz has a list of who's going to get the vaccine, these are the possibilities.
yet generally ill. You can correct me if I'm wrong. So those are most at risk of dying. Those are most essential in combating the pandemic. Those most at risk of exposure and illness, essential for the functioning of society. Those who suffered prior injustice, those who can pay for it, or let's say if you're a public health decision maker, your extended family, right? So when I ask, you know, thousands of people around the world which one of these is most would be their, you know, 1 through 7, this is more or less how it went. So, you know, in that order, which makes sense to some people and not sense to other people. But again, in theory, that's how it would go, usually how it goes. And when anthrax came, who got the Cipro? It was all the doctors and their families. Usually it seems to go the other way. So your extended family gets first, who can pay for the vaccine second, and then a mishmash of those others. So what's critically important after you create some kind of ethical principles for triaging things, it's figuring out how you make sure that those ethical principles and that sort of structure of priority actually gets effected and enforced. That's, you know, critically important. Without that, you might as well not put it all together. I'm going to skip some of that. I wanted to just point out that the health group one there, healthcare workers, paramedics, ambulance attendants, would be 600,000 people in Canada. So, that's pandemic influenza. For Ebola, it's not even on the radar, right? Because we only have 1,000 doses, 10,000 doses. So there's no way that's going to happen. So we have to go back to first principles. What am I timing at?
2 or 3 minutes left.
2 or 3 minutes left. Okay. So I will go quickly, maximizing out. So when I asked a bunch of public health physicians whether, basically, there's two real questions here, you can distill it all down. Is it maximizing aggregate well-being or fairness and equity that are really the most important sort of principles that are involved here? And they were more or less evenly split among thousands of people. So, and then a couple meeting professional standards and legislative norms. So I asked them to choose 1, 2, 3, 4, and that's how they chose. Now, interestingly, older people, more male people, chose the greater good is more important. More females, younger people said fairness and equity are more important. And then, you know, you would make a list from there. Nurses, much more interested in professional standards, and public health inspectors in legislative norms. So then the question, of course, is which one of these do you go by? Because in public health, we're all trying to work together, and yet we have very different conceptions of the list in terms of triaging folks. So is it principles, processes, or consequences that are more important? Principles like fairness, processes like transparency or legislative norms, or consequences like minimizing mortality, minimizing morbidity, that sort of thing. So the Joint Center for Bioethics put together a report, which is the basis for a lot of pandemic planning and the basis for a lot of what Public Health Ontario is doing as well. And so these are the values that they thought were important. They include myself there because I was involved in a couple of ways. Individual liberty, protection of public from harm, privacy, duty to provide care, the sort of things you would expect were in there. What they didn't do is prioritize them again. So, you know, leaving some things open and some challenges in terms of implementing it. So those were the substantive values. The procedural requirements, they had to be reasonable, open and transparent, inclusive, responsive, and accountable. A lot of those words are open for interpretation, especially reasonable. So those are some of the principles. The unique part that I at least argue, and we'll see if it's true in terms of the halakhic system, is that it incorporates the substantive and procedural values in one system. Theoretically makes a lot of sense, hopefully. And the four key issues that they describe were exactly the same. I'm going to skip a couple of these. So this is just how it was implemented here. In terms of prioritizing them, just one last slide in terms of prioritizing. I know nobody can see these, but these are 23 values that I ask people to prioritize. Right from trust and honesty, stewardship, equity, duty to care, responsive, individual liberty for public health practitioners, right on the bottom. Usually, certainly here in American, but in Canadian as well, individual liberty right at the top, in clinical care, in public health right at the bottom. The different colors here are the disagreement between groups and in terms of public health practitioners, physicians and inspectors. So equity was one of the ones they disagree about. Trust and honesty, always at the top. In all of the examples they gave me about ethical dilemmas they had, it always resulted in not truth-telling. So it was the number one value, but the value that was most often broken, which, you know, may be good or bad. So I'm just going to a couple of words on the bottom line is, in theory, we use evidence and we use ethics, and usually the big ethical principle right now that is sort of most current among ethicists is equity, focusing on marginalized and vulnerable populations. And in practice, it still, in some ways, is a convenience. So who's closest to the hospital when, random luck, first come, first serve, or that you have the right NGO in town. You know, if you had MSF in your town when whatever outbreak began, certainly in the Congo with the Ebola outbreaks, you were good. If you had another organization, you know, that's too bad for you. So not a really coherent strategy at the time, and it's getting more so. Okay, I only have less than minus 2 minutes to deal with the second question, so I'm just going to do it very superficially. The big difference in terms of ethics and Ebola globally is that there was a group that got together, including my PhD supervisor, on August 11th, and basically said that we're going to forget about that whole procedure for testing. Not forget about the whole thing, but we're going to allow some changes in how we test new therapies. We're going to essentially say we can test uncertain therapies on large populations after we prove they're safe, which we're still doing now, during an outbreak, which we haven't said we're able to do. There's lots of caveats that they put on that. The interesting ethical issues there, and I'm only going to raise them, I'm not going to try to answer them, are not, can we use experimental therapies in order to save lives? Because I think everybody would agree that we could. And we can, we do it regularly, but it's not about the individuals, it's about on a population. So it's a different question. Must there be adequate safeguards to protect individuals? Everybody agrees that there are. How do we protect communities, and how do we actually make sure those safeguards are in place? In the setting of an outbreak is very challenging, but pretty much everyone agrees on that. Will there really be full voluntary informed consent to people that you barely can talk to? Because I don't know if any of you have tried on those masks and suits. It's very difficult to communicate. So how that's going to happen, I'm not sure, but we all agree on it. Are there any alternatives to testing these therapies in an outbreak? And the answer, everyone would agree, is no. We have the only setting you can test them is in an outbreak because Ebola is so uncommon, or at least until recently. And so these are some of the principles that they were talking about. It's available online, but standard supportive care has to be provided. Right now, there isn't really infrastructure for doing that. There has to be some kind of infrastructure and equipment to implement whatever testing they're doing. Families and communities have to be involved. All of these things are not even happening now before there's research protocols in place. How are they going to happen when they're testing drugs? It's a huge challenge. We still have to do it, and everyone's going to have to do their best. But those ethical issues are somewhat uncontroversial. How to ethically gather evidence to establish efficacy. So usually what we do is randomized controlled trials. We give some people a placebo. We give some people the active agent. Is that ethical to do that in an outbreak situation? Everybody's shaking their heads, so good, you're paying attention. That's the sort of thing that we're trying to figure out, and there are technical ways of getting around that. Who will own the therapies? Many of you probably know that right now, Reynolds Tobacco Companies actually own ZMapp. Or at least a big part of it. So that's not something everybody is keen on. But who will own those therapies once they're tested? They go through that whole procedure, and they're probably worth an awful lot of money. And how do we separate these resources? So as soon as we get a research protocol, we've got a drug. We devote all our resources to testing that drug. What do we do about all the treatment and preventive stuff that's not part of that? So how do we use our very limited resources? So those are the easy questions. I'm not answering them. I'm going to leave Robert Turchino to do that. The hard questions are, it's not about individual diseases or therapies. What it's really about in terms of that drug testing is about global systems, power, money, and economies. This is billions, hundreds of billions, actually $1.2 trillion pharmaceutical industry. And if there is a way that they can avoid the way that they do things now that involves a lot of money, a lot of testing, a lot of time, that's going to be extremely valuable for them. So it's really about public health and population interests approach to pharmaceutical and health governance. This is just how drugs are tested and move through the pipeline now. And the point is, it takes about $4 to $12 billion over 10 to 15 years to put out a drug. Right? If there's a way that drug companies can use this sort of notion that we can bypass some of it, it's going to be very valuable. So the bottom line is, it's going to be messy. We don't have a choice about ethically allowing some kind of research to take place. But by what criteria should this happen again, if it does happen again? Is it the next next epidemic or existing one? So there's already far more people still that die of malaria, TB, HIV, all those diseases in those very countries where Ebola is present. Why are we not doing that kind of thing and setting aside those criteria for those diseases as well? And this fundamentally changes the $1.4 trillion industry and relationships with NGOs. So it's huge. Last slide, syndemic. I don't know how many of you have heard of it. A syndemic occurs when two or more afflictions interacting synergistically contribute to excess burden of disease in the population. So this is the real ethical issue. It's not just Ebola. It's non-existent health systems. It's other diseases. It's a huge pot of all kinds of ethical conundrums that are pre-existing. You know, we could have spent hours talking about the ethics of healthcare in Liberia before Ebola. Now it's just significantly worse. You think if you understand one, you understand two, because one and one are two, you must also understand and. In other words, there's all these things going on at the same time, which makes things extremely, extremely difficult. And finally, for every complex human problem, there's an answer that is clear and simple and wrong. That's it.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your informative presentation. We'll now turn the floor over to Mr. Cheater.
Okay. I didn't really want to hear an uh-oh. So thank you very much for coming out this evening. I also want to especially thank the panelists, as well as Shari Shamayim, in the person of Rabbi Chess is here, and Rabbi Strauchler, who couldn't be here tonight. Over Sukkot was when I had the idea that maybe we should perhaps have this, you know, sort of a conversation about it, and I reached out to Barry by email, and Barry said, sure, why not? And then Dr. Schwartz signed on, and I'm glad to be able to have this program. I'd rather be listening, but that was part of the price of having the program. But what I'm going to say now certainly does not constitute practical Jewish law advice. These are thoughts on the questions at hand. So I'm going to go first with the question of whether treatments should be used if they have not undergone safety testing. Now, when Dr. Pegas dealt with this question, he dealt with it more from the perspective of World Health Organization trying to figure out whether to actually use these treatments, not use these treatments, do research on them, not do research on them. I'm looking at it from a little bit of a different perspective. I'm looking at it from the patient's perspective. The question of whether the patient should be able to use these treatments which have not yet undergone safety testing. And I'm working with an assumption which you see on the slide there. The assumption that I'm working with, I hope it says on the slide there. No, that's fine. Is that we're talking about patients who are fully aware of the dangers involved in using such a treatment and are opting it of their own free will. Now, as was already pointed out, that isn't necessarily the case. Communication is difficult. The level of medical sophistication also is unclear to me. So the question of whether the patients are fully informed is an important one. But the assumption that I'm going to make is that you're dealing with people who are informed and who say, we would like to actually do this. We would like to receive the treatment. And the fundamental question is whether gambling is permitted. Does a human being have the right to endanger whatever life he or she has left in pursuit of mitigating pain, in pursuit of extending life? So as a basic principle within Judaism, it's brought in the Talmud in the tractate called Yuma, we say that chayei sha'ah, short-term life, is of critical importance. A Jew is not permitted to throw away even short-term life. So the Talmud there discusses a case in which there's an accident of some kind and a person is stuck under the rubble and I would have to violate Shabbat in order to get the person out. And if, as I, the rescuer, I'm looking at the patient, that this person under the rubble, I say, you know what, he's only going to make it for another 15 minutes if I dig him out. Nonetheless, that's exactly what I am supposed to do. Even this short-term life is of primary importance, and that is in fact codified in Jewish law, in the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. I brought a quote here from Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, writing about 20 years ago, in which he said, we have no measuring stick for the value of life. It is all of infinite value. If so, if I were to stop there and say, even short-term life is of infinite importance, then I might be driven to say that you shouldn't gamble away short-term life. You shouldn't say, well, you know what, it hasn't been safety tested, but I want to take it anyway. Maybe you should say, leave that on the side. Don't try that that treatment. However, there is also a recognition within Jewish law that what's called chaye olam, long-term life, is of greater value than chaye sha'a, short-term life. So, for example, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, writing in the early 20th century, dealt with the question of somebody who is a fireman. The fireman goes to the fire and sees that there are two people who are trapped in the flames. One of them, based on the immediate on-the-spot assessment, one of them seems to be in a position where even if you get him out, he's only going to last another hour, smoke inhalation damage, whatever it is. The other one looks like you could actually get this person out of the fire, and that person will be treatable and will be able to live out their natural lifespan. So he asks the question, which one do you save? And his answer is, you save the one who appears to you to be able to survive to the term of his natural life. In other words, what he says is we prioritize the one for whom you can provide, so to speak, full life. And we have precedent for this already in biblical text. There's a story in the book of Malachim, Bet Kings 2, chapter 7, regarding four people who are outside of a town. And the town was not just any town, it was a military camp of a nation called Aram. And the four people who are outside of the camp are starving to death. And they see that the camp seems to be abandoned. And so they want to go into the camp to try to get food. But they're worried, because if in fact the camp is not abandoned, if it's a trick, a trap of some kind, then they are immediately going to be killed by the people in this camp, the camp of Aram. And so their question is, do we risk it? Do we go into the camp knowing that that might be the end of our lives right now, but on the other hand, if in fact it is abandoned, then we'll be able to get food and we'll be able to save ourselves and we'll be able to save all the other people who are starving. That's the case that's discussed biblically, and the right answer in that story seems to be to in fact risk their lives and go and investigate, which they do, and they find the camp is abandoned and everybody lives happily ever after until the catastrophe in the next chapter. But the message that emerges from that story is that one is indeed entitled within in Jewish tradition to risk temporary life for the sake of long-term life. And so we get a lot of text. And so we get the following decision from Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein dealt with the following case. Regarding the case of two patients, one for whom doctors estimate that they can only provide short-term healing, extending life as much as possible, perhaps removing pain, but this patient needs immediate treatment. And then they have a second one who shows up at the same time at the ER, whom they estimate they can heal, but they don't know whether he needs immediate care, like the first one. There's only one bed in the unit, so I have two people to take care of. One, I can only help short-term. The other one, I can actually help long-term. I think I can help long-term. So Rabbi Feinstein ruled, and this ruling goes back about 40 years already, he says, it appears in my humble opinion that if both patients arrive simultaneously, meaning they have yet to bring either one into the ER, they must first bring in the one whom the doctors on scene believe they can heal, meaning long-term life, if there is even a possibility that they would need to begin his treatment immediately. In other words, if I think that in order to be able to achieve this long-term treatment, I need to start now, that's the one I'm going to take first. Long-term life will have precedence over short-term life. So, again, what we've established is, the challenge is, short-term life, we're told, is of great value, and therefore I shouldn't be able to risk it. Long-term life, on the other hand, is of greater value. So then maybe I should be able to risk the short-term life. So the ruling that tends to be given is, indeed, that one is permitted to take that risk. Not obligated to take the risk, but permitted to take the risk. And a couple of examples of this. I brought you a source here, a passage in the Talmud. The Talmud there is talking about certain physicians who were suspected of animosity towards Jews. And I don't mean animosity like they don't like Jews. I mean animosity like if they have a Jewish patient at their mercy, they may well kill him. This is a reality from a couple of thousand years ago. And so the Talmud says, you know, as a general rule, if you're afraid your doctor might kill you, you should find another doctor. But what if I'm not covered by my insurance? No, you don't go to such a physician. However, the Talmud writes the following. If we are uncertain whether he will live or die if left untreated, we don't know. So that one may not be treated by these physicians who are suspected. If he will definitely die without treatment, then he may be treated by them. If he's going to die anyway, it's only a question of whether it's going to be right now at the hands of the physician or longer term. If he doesn't get treated, the answer is, we're told here, he should be treated by the physicians. The Talmud asks, but even in the case of death, even where he's afraid he's going to die of his illness, he still risks his short-term life. He's shortening his life by going to this dangerous physician. To which the Talmud says, yeah, but we're not concerned about short-term life. Not that we're really not concerned, but that our desire for long-term life trumps. And this was ruled by Rabbi Yaakov Emden, writing in the 18th century, as well as Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, there he is again, in the writing in the 20th century. He dealt with a case of surgery in which a patient has the following. A patient has a painful condition, or perhaps a condition that actually is shortening his life. And the patient says, I have the option of getting some kind of treatment, for some kind of surgery, which isn't proven. It may not work. The patient may die on the operating table. But if the operation works, then they'll be able to live long term. What do they do? So Rabbi Feinstein ruled, as you see there on the slide, that the patient is permitted to opt for this surgery, to opt for this operation. Rabbi Avram Sofer Abraham, writing in Israel, also recorded this in his Nishmas Avram. And so the upshot of it, in terms of this initial question that we asked, the question of whether treatments may be used if they have not undergone safety testing, the answer seems to be, assuming that there is a reasonable chance that this could work, and reasonable, frankly, is not decided by the rabbi, reasonable is decided by the doctor. But if there is a reasonable chance to think that this could succeed, then the patient is indeed entitled to take on this this treatment despite the potential risk. That's number one. I'm not dealing with the question that Dr. Pagus threw in at the end, the question of what is this going to do to your overall testing procedures for medications, the sort of public health side of it. I'm looking at more clinically in terms of the individual patient who wants to be treated. That was question number one. Question number two was the question of how should treatments be prioritized? How do we decide who receives this? And it's a basic ethical challenge, because we are taught that all life is valuable, all lives are valuable. The decision of exactly who I'm going to save cannot be based on my personal favorites. Well, I like that one, and therefore that one's going to get it. So what am I supposed to do? A couple of points. Point number one is that within the idea that all lives are valuable or all life is valuable, not all life is equal. So, for example, we already saw Roy Feinstein make the statement in one of the previous slides that if two patients come to the ER at the same time and there's one I believe I can save for long-term life and one I can only save for short-term life, I take the long-term life. So clearly we do prioritize, and we make the statement that those who have a better chance of survival go first. That's number one. Number two, once the patient is already in my care, that's the one who has my responsibility. That's the one to whom I am responsible. So if you take a look on your slides, you see a quote from Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who said, once a patient is brought into the unit for treatment, the patient acquires the space. Now, the word acquire may make one think of something financial. So Rabbi Feinstein therefore stresses, it doesn't matter whether the patient is paying for his time in the hospital or whether he does not pay, it doesn't make a difference. The patient, by being there, by being under my care, has what could be called in law a relationship of care. There are various terms that are used for it, but I am responsible to this particular patient. Similarly, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham wrote in his Nishmas Avram, writing in Israel within about 10 years ago. He says if the doctor has already begun treating one patient or has connected him to the equipment, and then a second patient needing the doctor's treatment or that machine comes in, the doctor may not leave the first patient to treat the second. One may not take the equipment from the first patient to connect it to the second patient. That's simply not an option. The one I've begun to treat is the one I continue to treat. So those are two basic rules already. But can we prioritize further? Are we able to do better with this? And the answer is yes. I did say that we're not permitted to be selfish. However, we are going to later say, Chayecha Kodmin. I'm going to quote a passage from the Talmud which says, my life comes first. In the event that I have resources at my disposal to save myself, the classic case which we're going to see, two people are walking in the wilderness, they have enough water such that one of them can make it to safety. The water is being held by one of these two travelers. He gets to keep the water for himself. Why? Because your life comes first. You aren't expected to give up your life for somebody else. Taking that principle as a starting point, but expanding it to a society. If a society has enough to take care of itself, then that indeed is what's going to come first. The society worries about itself before others. But I want to be broader than that. Because the word self actually is not a narrow term. Self can actually be broader. I brought you three different ideas here. Number one, the passage from the Talmud that I brought on the top of the current slide. The Talmud states, this is regarding the laws of tzedakah, of philanthropy. So the Talmud states, based on a biblical verse, if you have a choice between helping out the needy within your city and the needy, I'm sorry, between your own needy, meaning your family, or other people who are in need who are in the city, your own family comes first. And if you have a choice between your city and the needy of another city, so your city is going to have priority over another city. That doesn't mean I shouldn't care about everybody else. We actually had a Beit Midrash program about a year ago on the importance of caring about what happens in the world as a whole and reaching out to the world as a whole. This is not to deny that. However, we do have clear biblical precedent recorded in the Talmud that our local needy come first, and the idea in theory is all the populations worry about their local needy and then hopefully everybody is taken care of. But that's number one. But number two, when we say self, take care of yourself, that doesn't just mean you and your local people. It also extends to those needed by society. The bottom passage from the Talmud that I brought on this slide is talking about a little bit of an esoteric situation. Classically, historically, going back to biblical times, you had a Kohen, a priest, who was charged with leading the army out to war. Why? What did he do? Great discussion, not for right now. But he was called a Mashuach Milchama. He was anointed to lead the nation to war. And then you had another Kohen, another priest, who was the deputy to the Kohen Gadol, to the high priest. And the Talmud asks a question. Let's say both of them were in danger and you could only save one of them. Which one of them would you save? A little bit of an, as I said, it's an esoteric case, but with a very real world lesson. The answer the Talmud brings is that you save the one who leads the army. And the commentators explain the reason is because the one who leads the army is needed by society. So that teaches us another principle, which is we prioritize those who are needed by society. Who is needed by society? The governing officials have to figure that out. Who is truly necessary? Who is necessary just because their title says they're necessary? What exactly, what role do they serve? These are all good questions. But that's a basic principle as well. And then the last principle that I'm going to bring is regarding healthcare workers. I bring here two responsa dealing with a separate situation, one that the Jewish community unfortunately is put in the position to think about quite frequently. And by the way, the previous two sources that I brought, just wanted to mention, they're also brought in a very good article that's available online called The Division of Scarce Resources and Triage in Halacha, written by a fellow by the name of Judah Goldschmidt in a journal put out by the Albert Einstein College of Medicine of Yeshiva University. So you can find that article online. He has a good discussion about the points that I just raised about local and about those needed by society. But the one I want to get to now is the following. The two pieces that I brought there are from responses dealing with the issue of prisoner exchanges. What happens when Israeli soldiers, or Israeli civilians for that matter, but here I'm dealing with soldiers, have been taken captive, and those who are holding them captive say, we will release them in the event that you will free X number of convicted murderers, X number of convicted terrorists. So the question now is, what do you do? And historically, governments in the state of Israel have indeed released people, have indeed released prisoners for the sake of such exchanges. The two authors here, both venerable rabbis, Rabbi Chaim David Halevi and Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli, both justified the practice of releasing prisoners for the sake of ransoming soldiers. And the first source I brought you, Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, writing about, I believe he wrote this, already about 50 to 60 years ago, he says the reason why they did this ransom, one of the reasons why, was before the eyes of the determining authority was an additional important point, the morale of the soldiers of the IDF. When a soldier knows that should he fall captive, the entire state of Israel would stand behind him to free him, he will risk his life in battle without fear. In other words, it's about military morale. They need to know that if they're taken captive, the government is going to stand behind them. Similar, slightly different, but similar argument by Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli, who wrote in the bottom quote, because they will go to war on a mission of the nation and for its sake to defend the nation dwelling in Zion, there is an unwritten, understood obligation that the nation will use every means at its disposal within reasonable boundaries so as not to endanger national security. That's a good caveat. Try explaining that. But to redeem them should they fall captive. The point being that both of them state, you need to make sure that your soldiers are going to be confident that they can do their job and that you honor your responsibility to them. I am borrowing from those sources to apply it here because of healthcare workers. How am I going to send healthcare workers to take care of patients with Ebola and not guarantee that I'm going to treat them in the event that they fall sick? It's absurd. It's just as absurd as sending a soldier out to war and saying, I'm not going to save him if he falls captive. And so the argument that I would like to make here is that in addition to the criteria we've already given, and this is the summary, if I was talking too quickly, we've already said that yes, all life is valuable. We've said that we prioritize those with a better chance of survival. We've said that we prioritize somebody we are already treating. But in addition to those points, we prioritize the local over the global. We prioritize those needed by society, and we prioritize specifically healthcare workers because we want them to go out and help others. There are more Jewish sources you could bring. There is a Mishnah at the end of a volume of the Talmud called Horiot that has a whole discussion about Kohen, Levi, and Yisrael. But unless you're going to ask the Gabbai exactly, you know, which patient is a Kohen, I'm not sure that's going to really work in the hospital. But the point in bringing this, I think, is to show that yes, we do have sources that address these questions, and this is at least a beginning to how we address them. And I will now turn over the floor.
Okay, thank you so much, Rabbi Tarchiner. We're going to transition now from some of the global ethical issues of prioritizing treatment and experimental treatment to deal with more local questions. And two questions that we're going to focus on are, one, is a physician obligated to treat an Ebola patient? And two, does governments have the right to impose mandatory quarantines? Dr. Schwartz.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi. I'm very low tech, and I want to leave enough time for Rabbi Tarchiner to respond. I do want to make a couple of points. First of all, a lot of what I'm going to say is drawn from this document that Barry pointed out, Anna Gardner-Reed, published in 2005. People need to understand, authored by Toronto authors, including Dr. Pacus. This is a seminal document upon which ethical frameworks for pandemics and other diseases are based over the last 8 to 10 years. It did inform a lot of the actions during H1N1 in 2009, and in fact was based very much on our experience in SARS, and that really is what brings it back to Ontario. How many of you were in Ontario during SARS in 2003? And how many of you, keep your hands up, were healthcare workers during that time? Okay. Did any of you actually treat SARS patients? A few. Sandy Finkelstein's not here. Right? Sandy just treated the index patient, number one. So I'd like to sort of walk you through from SARS to Ebola, okay, for each of these questions, and talk about what... I didn't ask that question because it would probably take the rest of the session, but I will deal with that because it informs much of the work that we're doing now, and actually has affected, I think, a lot of the decisions that have been made in the Ebola situation. So, first question, is a physician or nurse obligated to treat an Ebola patient? Well, of the 375 suspect and probable cases of SARS, there were no confirmed cases of SARS because we didn't have a test for it at the time. We do have a test for Ebola. Half of them were healthcare workers. Okay, now, I'll talk a little bit about later about the difference between SARS and flu and Ebola. But, I mean, that's a huge thing. It really speaks to your question about were healthcare workers vulnerable. Yes, we were very vulnerable. And yes, we knew nothing about SARS. We knew nothing about what worked and what didn't work. And that's how this precautionary principle was developed, because we didn't know very much about SARS, and we had to go to the highest degree of protection for healthcare workers available, which people weren't trained for. Nonetheless, people voluntarily came to work day after day, putting themselves and their families at risk. Would that happen again? Maybe not. We've had... My wife was laughing because I was quarantined twice, and my family felt very vulnerable. Would that happen again? Well, already we've seen potential work refusals in a potential Ebola situation in many areas of North America, where there's only been 9 cases in the States, and really only one that they didn't know about beforehand that came from West Africa. So, it's interesting that one of the things that the Joint Center for Bioethics and others have recommended is that the duty to care for health professionals be entrenched in codes of conduct. And in fact, you have a slide on this there. In the old days, the 1922 Canadian Medical Association Code of Ethics said, when pestilence prevails, it is physicians' duty to face the danger and to continue their labors for the alleviation of suffering, even at the jeopardy of their own lives. The American Medical Association used similar language in its Code of Ethics until the 1950s. And it's not clear as to why this disappeared, because it's no longer in codes of ethics of most healthcare workers. In fact, the 2004 Canadian Medical Association Code of Ethics post-SARS inserted the following. Consider the well-being of society in matters affecting health. That doesn't really quite cut it for duty of care, does it? So the question is really asked, is there a duty of care for nurses? The Canadian Nurses Association inserted in their 2008 statement, during a natural or human-made disaster, including a communicable disease outbreak, nurses have a duty to provide care using appropriate safety precautions. So they're now looking at, okay, we'll come to work, but society needs to protect us. There's a principle that Barry spoke about in the 10 principles, in the 10 fundamental parts of the duty of care, called reciprocity. So duty of care is one principle, but that's balanced by the need to protect healthcare workers. Rabbi Turchiner spoke of that right at the end of his remarks, talking about you can't send somebody over if you don't have a way of bringing them back. And in fact, that's what the Canadian government is struggling with right now in terms of sending healthcare workers over to Africa. Do we have the ability to bring them back once they get sick, like the Americans did with that first patient to Emory? Very important. Reciprocity principle. So there's a number of these principles. Duty to provide care versus reciprocity. Trust is very important because people won't listen to you unless they trust you. And that's related to being open and transparent. A lot of these ethical principles that have been developed through research and through, one might say, humanistic values that are based on religious values, perhaps. The final principle is that of solidarity, so that we need to have a sense that we're working together and not against each other when we're dealing with physicians and nurses and other healthcare workers working on or treating Ebola patients. So that's question number three. Question number four, should governments have the right to impose mandatory quarantine? And that's a big question if you've been following what's been going on in the last couple of weeks, particularly since the Dallas patient who came back from West Africa and ultimately infected at least two, maybe more, but at least two healthcare workers. The question has been, is quarantine recommended? And can it be enforced? Again, during SARS, quarantine was used quite extensively in Ontario, certainly in the SARS areas of the Far East, because we didn't know much about it. Influenza is contagious a day before symptoms appear. So the idea of quarantine by definition is the isolation of a well person to make sure that they don't infect anybody before they get sick. Once they get sick, what you do is you isolate. It's not called quarantine anymore. So when we discuss quarantine, we're talking about taking a well person off a plane from West Africa, or if they've been in contact with somebody with Ebola, and essentially isolating them from all contact for 21 days. That's an invasion of privacy, quite clearly. Okay? It infringes upon people's liberties, and you remember the differences between what public health people feel about the importance of liberty versus what the individual may feel about the importance of liberty. We talk about proportionality. Most of the quarantine or the public health legislation talks about whatever you do to reduce the spread of an illness has to be proportional to the spread of an illness so that you don't, swat a fly with a cannon. You don't take quarantine and enforce it on everybody who comes back from West Africa, unless there's a good reason. Now, we do know a couple of things about Ebola, and I know Rabbi Chessis' description was quite frightening, but the reality of Ebola is it's not that contagious. It does not spread through the air like SARS does or influenza does. It is only spread by direct contact, and in particular contact with body fluids. And the worst time for spread is, in fact, when the patient is near death or after death. People don't get SARS or influenza from a dead person. They will get Ebola from handling a dead corpse. And that's quite frightening. It's quite concerning. But it's much different than other diseases. You have to be close. You have to be caring for somebody. It also stands to reason, again, that Ebola is not contagious during the asymptomatic period. So the risk to the public from Ebola in Canada is essentially as close to zero as you can get. There's a theoretical risk for healthcare workers, which we're talking about if they're caring for an Ebola patient. So going back to the question of quarantine, should you do what the evidence says you should do, and that's monitor somebody for symptoms, and as soon as they get symptoms, isolate them, because we know science shows that you're not going to get Ebola from somebody who's asymptomatic. But what if somebody doesn't know they're having symptoms? Or what if they don't quarantine themselves fast enough? Or what if they don't isolate themselves fast enough to seek medical care when they get symptoms if they've had an exposure to Ebola? Hence the political decision to, in many states, for example, to enforce quarantine. The Canadian government is probably coming out with an announcement in the next couple of days on mandatory quarantine at border crossings in Canada. So you're going back to liberty versus protection of the public from harm, taking public health measures that are proportional to the threat of disease,
ensuring somebody's privacy to the extent that they can, and again, reciprocity. So because if you quarantine somebody, you really need to look after them. If you're taking away their means of livelihood for 3 weeks, you got to ensure they're paid. If they can't go out for groceries, you got to make sure that they're delivered. And you need to look after the people in whom we're restricting their liberties. I'll turn it over now.
Thank you very much. Two questions then. Is a physician obligated to treat an Ebola patient, and should government have the right to impose mandatory quarantine? Thank you. So first of all, in terms of the question of whether under Jewish ethics a physician would be obligated to treat an Ebola patient, you know, fundamentally we do understand within Judaism that a physician is obligated to treat people who are ill. The commandments that are found biblically range from love your neighbor as yourself to restoring somebody's lost property to not standing by while someone's blood is shed. And in fact, we have a rule stated in the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, that treating patients is a mitzvah, and one who refrains is a murderer, a shedder of blood. So that makes it sound like you're obligated, and we can now move on to the next question. However, we also have to consider the passage from the Talmud, which I referred to earlier, and is found at the bottom of the slide. It's the case of the two travelers, and they have one jug of water, which one of them is holding. If both of them drink, then both of them will die. If one of them will drink, he will reach civilization. So first, there was a sage named Ben Vitura who said, you don't want to cause somebody else to die, better to share the water, and both of them will die. But Rabbi Akiva came along and made the statement, which is accepted indeed in Jewish law, saying that the biblical text says, v'chei achicha imach, which we explain in this context to mean, the life of your brother is with you, meaning you only have to worry about your brother's life if you have your own life. So your life precedes your friend's life. That's the passage in the Talmud which is relevant for our discussion, and therefore you could make the argument that the healthcare worker can say, my life comes before the patient's life, I'm not going to treat him at risk to myself. So that's our key ethical question. As a general rule, the trend among authorities in Jewish law is to say that one should treat, assuming the risk is what doctors consider to be manageable, normal risk for healthcare workers. Now, what defines manageable and normal may become clear in the course of my next comments. The Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, writing in his response to Yabia Omer, dealt with the case of kidney donation. Going back, this response, I believe, goes back about 40 to 50 years. And he understood from the physicians that he consulted that the risk involved in donating a kidney was very low. And so he says, it appears certain that one may donate, and there is a mitzvah too, and he quotes the sage Radbaz writing in the 16th century, that when it comes to to saving someone else's life, even at potential risk, one is obligated to save him. Now he was bothered, because that was one statement by the 16th century sage, that one should risk himself in order to save somebody else. However, the same sage, Radbaz, Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra, writing in Spain, also said that a person who introduces himself into potential danger to save somebody else is a pious fool. So which is it? Is it meritorious, or is it foolishness? And his answer was, it depends on the circumstance, it depends on the level of risk. As you see on the excerpt there, one must say that Radbaz distinguishes between real risk and small risk. If the odds are inclined towards successful rescue without danger to the rescuer, then one who does not rescue is in violation of the principle of you shall not stand by while your brother's blood is shed. So Rabbi Ovadia Yosef argues that if the risk is low, and he does not give us a number for low, but if the risk is low, then one does indeed, it is meritorious for one to try to save others. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg took a related tack. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg was an authority in Jewish law. passed away. It's now got to be about 10 years ago. He was the authority for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Israel, and he dealt with many of these cases on a practical level. And in a responsum on this issue, he made two related points. But basically, both related points feed into the idea that a certain degree of risk is normal in practicing medicine. And you see on the slide there the quote from him. He writes, "It further appears to me..." Nope, next one. Just kidding. There we go. He says, after writing a great deal about the topic, he says, "It further appears to me that one could say this regarding a doctor. Since it is standard that the doctor, who knows diseases and ailments, provides necessary aid. And without this, there would be great devastation for the ill and the healthy. Meaning, if you didn't have doctors treating people, the results would be terrible for society. Therefore," he says, "he's acting in a standard way for the normal function of the world. What the doctor is doing is just what doctors always do, day in and day out. They face a certain degree of risk. And the risk involved in treating the sick is not considered, quote, introducing oneself into forbidden risk." He says this is considered normal. What he's relying on is a principle articulated in the Talmud in a few different contexts, which is that in the normal course of living, we enter into risky situations. We get on a plane. We drive a car. Right? We do things that involve a certain element of risk. So he says, that's just the way the medical system functions, is that there are people who take on this degree of risk. And he then continues to add another note. There are people who engage in dangerous trades, dangerous livelihoods, construction workers who are going to go up on a crane or whatever it is. There are risks involved in that which you do, and it's considered acceptable in Jewish law, as he writes. "It further appears, in my humble opinion, that since the doctor does this to treat the sick for a living, he is permitted to introduce himself into possible danger for this. It is like the way the Torah permitted a worker to enter danger for his livelihood." So the second point, the first point was Rabbi Ovadia Yosef. And Rabbi Yosef said that when risk is relatively low, it's justified in the name of saving others. The point that Rabbi Waldenberg makes, I believe, is subtly different. His point is, this is normal conduct, that there are doctors who enter into a degree of risk in order to take care of patients, and he says that's considered to be acceptable. He actually deals with a case which I'm going to come back to in a moment. There was a very interesting discussion in a work of responsa called Nishmat Kol Chai, Rabbi Chaim Palagi, regarding a doctor during an epidemic. And the synagogue wanted to block him from entering the synagogue because they were concerned that he was potentially contagious. So in the course of his discussion about potentially quarantining this physician, at no point does Rabbi Palagi come up and say, by the way, you shouldn't be treating patients, it's dangerous. That doesn't even dawn on him. It doesn't even enter the picture. It's considered normal. The last point I'll make on this, somebody who received an email publicizing this class forwarded to me an email from an organization in the States called the Beis Havad Halacha Center, and they had a discussion there regarding this issue of endangering oneself to treat a patient, and they mentioned the factor of Hatzalah Dirabim, saving the community. Yes, you're endangering yourself, but it's to save large numbers of people. They pointed out the case of Queen Esther in the Purim story, right? Queen Esther goes into the palace of Ahasuerus at great personal peril. What's the justification? The answer is, she may be in a position to actually save the community. So that's another argument is, it's the individual versus the needs of the community. So the bottom line out of this is, it does seem that assuming, and this is a big assumption, but assuming that the understanding of the medical community is that the risk is considered to be within acceptable bounds, and I'm deliberately not defining acceptable bounds, because I have suggestions, but no real, I can hang my hat on, so to speak. But if it's within acceptable bounds, then the doctor is indeed allowed to enter into that risk to treat the patients. Last question was the question of whether government has the right to impose mandatory quarantine. So we do believe in protecting life. We also believe, I can't see which slide I've got up there. Mandatory quarantine, excellent. We do believe in protecting life and protecting the life of the community. We also believe in ensuring people's freedom of movement. So what do? Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in the Code of Jewish Law in the beginning of the 16th century, was adamant about the importance of saving yourself. If you look at what he writes there, he says, one should avoid anything that introduces risk. Danger is more serious than the Torah's prohibitions. One should flee a city when there is plague present. One should flee at the start of the plague, by the way, he says, not at its end. Good advice. All of these rules, he says, of protecting oneself are due to danger. One who guards himself will distance himself from them. One may not depend on miracles or endanger himself in anything like this. That's on the one hand. And it is the right and responsibility of government to protect its citizens. We have a principle of dina d'malchusa dina, that Jewish law says the law of the land, in particular when it's enacted to protect society as a whole, is binding and must be honored. On the other hand, there's a fascinating article by Rabbi Chaim David Alevi. I mentioned him before when we were talking about prisoner exchanges. So he wrote a very interesting article called Onesh HaMaasar BaHalacha. Literally means the punishment of imprisonment in Jewish law. And he is adamant that the Torah is against imprisoning people and taking away their freedom of movement. It's a very interesting piece. He points out that if you look at, and this is what this quote is taken from, he points out that if you look at the litany of potential punishments that appear in biblical texts, you do not find imprisonment. The only case that's sort of imprisonment is the city of refuge for someone who kills a person accidentally. Excuse me, but that's for his protection from the relatives of his victim, so they're not allowed to enter the city and attack him. A discussion we could have about the city of refuge phenomenon another time, but my point in presenting this is that Rabbi Chaim David Alevi makes an argument which he buttresses from various sources that we don't remove human liberty. So, on the one hand, you're supposed to protect yourself and protect society, and that's the job of government. On the other hand, we don't want to restrict people's liberty. So, the answer given by Rabbi Chaim Palagi in the case I mentioned before, the doctor they wanted to bar from the synagogue, is that it was within the rights of the community to quarantine. The community has the ability within Jewish law and Jewish ethics to say, sorry, we are going to imprison you. We may be required to take care of you, as Dr. Schwartz mentioned. But we have the right to restrict your freedom of movement. One source that he brings comes from a comment by Tosfot. Tosfot is an early commentary to the Talmud. It's a collection of commentaries, actually, from the 12th, 13th, 14th centuries. 12th and 13th, primarily. And there you find the line, which and we'll bring right here. You see it at the top. One is more obligated to be careful not to harm others than to protect himself from harm. I have a greater responsibility to make sure I don't hurt other people than to keep other people from hurting me. What we said before about your life being first notwithstanding, I may not be the agent of harm to others. And therefore, the physician who says, I want to go into the synagogue, is not at liberty to do so. If he may be dangerous to the community, he's not allowed. And he gives a very interesting example from the Mishnah. So this is a text now going back 2,000 years. They're dealing with the case of a mitzora. Without getting into it in great depth, the mitzora conveys a degree of impurity to people if he occupies the same space as them. It's a ritual impurity. So how does he get to go to the synagogue? So the Mishnah gives us the answer. It says, when the Mitzora enters the synagogue, they put up a divider. He's responsible to get there first, so he can be behind the Mechitza, right? Here you have two sections, right? You have a men's section and you have a women's section in the synagogue. So now you have three sections. You have the men's, the women's, and the Mitzora, and you have the female Mitzora, the male Mitzora, smoking, and The smoking is another topic, but the idea here is that he has the responsibility. He has to show up first so he can be ensconced in his safe area and wait until everybody else has left from Kiddush before he's able to go out, lest he communicate this to them. He doesn't have the right to say it's their problem, not my problem. He is indeed responsible to worry about them. Now, Rabbi Palagi concludes his remarks with a very important point, which is, once again, it's about the medical facts. I keep reiterating this because it's relevant for all the questions. If the answer is that people are being hyper-concerned about something they need not be concerned about, then no, you don't have the right to imprison him. You don't have the right to quarantine him. The question is still, what is the level of risk to the community? And at what point is it an overreaction? It's fundamentally a medical question. But if doctors believe that there is significant risk to the community, then it is considered to be justified. Thank you.
Wow. That's a lot. Thank you so much. Thank you for these highly informative and intriguing presentations. At this point, I'd like to open the floor for questions. We'll hopefully have a chance to take a few. And if you'd like to specify who the question is addressed to, that might be helpful, but we'll also give everyone an opportunity if it's appropriate. Go ahead.
It has been touted recently by the right-wing media that one way to stop spread of Ebola would be to effectively restrict all air travel between the affected countries and the United States or perhaps Canada, as has been done apparently very successfully in other countries in West Africa, such as Nigeria. What is the stance of the Ontario government or Canadian government on this issue, and is there a halakhic dimension associated with this as well?
I'm just going to repeat the questions for the sake of the audio recording here. So briefly, should travel be restricted as a result of this Ebola scare from a public health perspective and from a halakhic perspective?
Public health first.
Well, restricting travel, to my knowledge, is not being considered by Canada. They are considering, again, various levels of quarantine, people who do come from those areas. And again, there were some calculations that Barry referred to. We know that it's really between 4 and 24 people a week from West Africa to Ontario. There's no direct ones, so you have to find them. The economic and some might say moral consequences of restricting all travel are very high. Again, you know, closing your borders to people from certain countries smacks of racism, etc. Will make the issue much worse because you can't send people over there if you can't bring them back. And I've heard it put in some ways that you know, the more the fires are burning over in West Africa, the more sparks will end up here regardless, one way or the other. So I think certainly from a policy perspective, to my knowledge, I'm not speaking for Public Health Ontario or the Ontario government on this, that travel restrictions as have been touted by many are neither going to be that helpful, ultimately it might be helpful in the short term, nor appropriate animal mobility.
Thank you.
So to speak to the halakhic question, theoretically you could point your hand to the last question, which was the one about the quarantine, and say, well, if we approve the idea of quarantine within a community and say this person should not be allowed because of the risk, so ostensibly we could apply a quarantine there. However, there is, I think, a countervailing concern we'd have to be very careful about. And that is that, you know, we have sort of meta principles within Jewish law when it comes to a great need for society, in which we say that even if the law seems to point to a certain practice or to allow a certain practice, it's still not a good idea on behalf of society. And here I would actually think that it, again, depending on the level of risk involved, we might have to consider the additional point that when you close your doors, that is often the step before saying, and therefore I don't have to do anything. In other words, assuming you could actually successfully do it, which, again, as Dr. Schwartz points out, is highly questionable. But assuming that I knew I could snap my fingers, and that's it. No one gets here from Liberia. No one gets here from West Africa. Or even, no one gets here from anywhere with Ebola. Let's say I could do that. If that's going to lead my society to say, therefore I have no obligation to help anybody, then I'm not actually sure that's a good idea. Because we have this concern of making sure that we don't shut ourselves off to the point of not assisting others. So to a certain extent, that application will depend on the level of risk. But I think from a Torah ethics standpoint, we want to make sure we don't get to that position in which we say, therefore, we're not going to fulfill our obligations to the global community. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. Possibly have a lot of questions for our engineer on the community of care for a healthcare worker and evaluating risks. You talked about one of the examples you gave from the example of a traveler through the desert sharing water or not sharing water there. But caring for an Ebola patient is potentially a high risk if the person, if the healthcare worker isn't properly protected. Could you, from a logic standpoint, consider an Ebola patient to potentially be a road agent, somebody pursuing the life of a healthcare worker? Is a healthcare worker allowed to flee the person chasing them so that they're not? We talked a little bit about that, about leaving the plague. So just for the obligation of the healthcare worker to treat the duty of care, maybe bringing issues of reciprocity, how does that all balance? Maybe people to patients later on.
Right. So I'll repeat it as part of my answer. The question that Leon asks is whether this person who is sick, this Ebola patient, should be considered a rodef. Rodef is a technical term in Jewish law. It refers to someone who is pursuing somebody else, literally, to kill them. Now, that is correct that a person can be a rodef without intent. In other words, one could be classified as attempting to murder without any sort of knowledge that he is attempting to murder. The extreme case is the discussion about a woman who is in labor and the fetus is trying to come out and is endangering her life in its attempt to emerge from the womb. There is potentially the possibility of classifying that fetus as a rodef, even though the fetus obviously has no knowledge of anything. So there is such a concept as classifying someone as a rodef. However, I don't think you need to go there. In other words, if the level of risk is as high as you're describing, and I'm not sure I accept that medically, but if the medical risk is really that high, then even if I did not call him a pursuer, I would still say the healthcare worker is obligated to protect his life and run the other way regardless. You follow? So if the risk were really at the stage where I was going to call the person a rodef, the healthcare worker wouldn't be in the room in any case. So that's why I'm not sure what that would add.
And how far does society go with, okay, from a lot of standpoint, with reciprocity and the duty to protect healthcare workers and provide appropriate protective equipment and in terms of allocation of resources to protect workers so they can deliver appropriate care?
I think they have to go as far as the medical community is going to require of them. In other words, I'm going to use the phrase within reason, understanding that requires definition. But within reason, if the healthcare community says we need measures 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in order to be able to treat patients, then that's what they need. And that's what society then is going to be responsible to provide.
So Dr. Schwartz mentioned the precautionary principle going above and beyond. But in the United States, one imported Ebola patient, I think the rest were, in terms of not being aware of it, the rest of either secondary cases or repatriated healthcare workers. So, I mean, there's a lot of issues.
Yes, agreed. To repeat it for the audio, he said there were a lot of issues.
Can I ask a question? So, I just want to respond to it. Well, really ask the question of Rabbi Torchiner. So, I mean, it all makes an awful lot of sense in terms of an individual physician can, let's just assume it's an extremely high risk. So an individual physician can run the other way. Should they run the other way is another question. But in my mind, at least, there has to be a halakhic justification somehow, or a halakhic way in which outbreaks, which are fundamentally not about individuals. So in other words, if we have a halakhic system, and let's imagine for a moment that Israel is not where the Jewish people live, but in the United States, and there's 300 million people, and we have a, you know, we have to run an entire large society. We can't have a situation in which everybody is running away because our understanding of outbreaks is different now. We realize that someone needs to be, there needs to be a system in place for treating and containing these outbreaks. And we are all going to be, you know, dead in the end if we don't find a way of doing it. So my question, what do we consider those Doctors Without Borders, those MSF folks, which in this case have really saved the planet, although I do have some disagreements with them usually, but they, in fact, I'm debating him on Friday, the president, but they've saved the planet on this one. Are they Hasid Shote, or are they Hasid Umodala, or something? Like, if all the Jews stand back from participating in some way, we're relying on everybody else, which seems problematic.
Right. So Barry's asking a really good question as an outgrowth of Leon's question. And Barry, you know, I should have thought in advance that you were going to ask me this, because Barry and I have this debate all the time on various topics. But the answer is yes. The answer is yes. That even though we've said that where there is a certain level of risk, it is the right and even the responsibility of the physician to protect his own life and to not treat, and in fact to run the other way. Nonetheless, we articulated earlier the principle of Hatzalah Derabim, of saving the community, and the idea that if everyone is going to run the other way, then no one is going to save the community, and then the epidemic is going to run rampant, then we can't have that either. The problem is still, so how do you decide who remains behind? Right? How do you decide who is going to be the one to do it? Do you go based on sort of a reversal of the prioritization principles that we defined earlier? So we'll say, well, let's take out the ones who are most needed by the community. Let's take out the ones who are, you know, your local. How exactly do you decide who remains behind to treat is a question I'm not prepared to answer. But the principle is correct. That just as I said before, you wouldn't close your borders entirely if you could at all avoid it, because you can't shut out the world. Similarly, you can't say none of us are going to treat and we're just going to let them all die. That's also not an acceptable answer within society. The application still being something I don't have an answer for. Right, so you're right. That's exactly what we're suggesting. What was suggested here is that if you follow this principle, the principles of prioritization that we gave, and we say that once you start treating a patient, you now have some kind of contract with them such that you're obligated to continue, then if you started treating, and the case given here, the case that Esther gave was, you start treating the 99-year-old, and then 5 minutes later, the 5-year-old is brought in, are you really going to say that you have to stick with the 99-year-old? And my answer is, I think yes. I think yes. It's a difficult situation. There's no question. But fundamentally, when you define an ethical principle and say that I have a responsibility to this person, then you don't get to overthrow it, even in a case where you really want to. The argument for the logic for saying the person I started with, I have a relationship with, is sound logic. You know, if you didn't give me the hard case that you're giving me, I would say, of course this makes perfect sense. And you know the principle, hard cases make bad law. Right? If we're going to now change it and say, well, we're going to say that you have a duty to care for this person unless it's a 5-year-old who comes in next, then what do you do when it's a 6-year-old, or it's a 30-year-old, or it's a whatever? Possibly. I don't know in the field whether whether the rules are applied flexibly or not. That, you know, I'll turn to the physicians to say. But the what I'm suggesting is not only a Jewish law principle. I gave a class about this last June, about not this topic, but a related topic, and invoked the principle and showed there that Justice McLaughlin, who I think now is the Chief Justice on the Supreme Court of Canada, but when she was not yet Chief Justice, she had a case before her in which she articulated the same point, that the patient who comes to you first is indeed the one you have a relationship with, and contract was her term, and that in fact you wouldn't be able to to change it. I don't doubt that on a battlefield, so to speak, you know, in an ER, things may be applied more flexibly than in a legal textbook. But if you ask me what I think it should be, those are the rules that I understand.
Okay, we'll take one more last question. Go ahead.
Another question for Colin. I'm a geriatrician. It's much harder to kill a 99-year-old than a 5-year-old.
Fair point.
Okay. Look, I think it's just important to recognize also that those are the in-the-field hospital, in the ER, are clinical questions, and the fun part about public health ethics and dealing with these issues is that you have a lot more flexibility in the sense that you're making a policy, you don't have a contractual relationship with an individual patient. As the public health authority, you have a contractual obligation for everybody, so you have that flexibility in terms of other principles that would be at play in those situations. So,
as you said, the ethical dilemmas are more complex.
Right, they're more complex because you don't have that contractual relationship. Yeah, that's the problem. It's more interesting, but more challenging.
I'm just finding my source sheet from that class so I can give you the quote from Justice McLaughlin. Go on to the next question. If I can find it, I will.
Okay. Any more last questions?
Can you answer to that whole question of what happens in an ER?
The ER is one patient against another. I think a relevant question for this is sometimes when we do disaster exercises, where you've got an individual who is on a ventilator and is requiring a blood transfusion of 20 or 30 units, is still bleeding, and then you have a disaster where you might be able to save 10 patients. Giving 2 units of blood for each of those patients. What do you do with that one person whose prognosis is terrible, that is on the ventilator and getting the 20 units of blood, to essentially take that individual off the life support and with the potential of saving the lives of maybe 8 or 10 other people? And those dilemmas are very, very difficult. And in disaster triage, the answer is supposed to be, you have a talk with the family of the person who needs the 20 or 25 units. And you know, again, how these rules are applied are much different in a battlefield, for example.
I just wanted to, just to give you the quote, thank you for that. I just wanted to give you the quote from Chief Justice McLaughlin. It was a case in 1992, and she said, "The relationship of physician and patient can be conceptualized in a variety of ways. It can be viewed as a creature of contract, with the physician's failure to fulfill his or her obligations giving rise to an action for breach of contract. It undoubtedly gives rise to a duty of care, the breach of which constitutes the tort of negligence." So, again, this is a legal statement, and just like my legal statements from a Jewish law perspective, her statement from a Canadian law perspective may not carry a lot of weight in an ER. And maybe the answer is the conversations that then go on. But yes, you ask the question. From a legal perspective, you define a rule and you say this is the way we're going to do it.
Okay, thank you so much. I'd like to thank our panelists for an absolutely fascinating conversation. It's really an incredible blend of public health wisdom and halacha. Thank you everyone here for joining. Have a lovely evening.